Chapter 57. But I begin to be afraid that my legs will hardly carry me there such a night as this. I am not so young as I was. If they are interrupted in their flight, she will be sure to come back to me, and I ought to be at the house to receive her. But be it as 'twill, I can't walk to the quiet woman, and that's an end on't. I'll go straight home. It will perhaps be best, said Clem. Thomason, dry yourself, and be as comfortable as you can. With this he closed the door upon her, and left the house in company with Captain Vi, who parted from them outside the gate, taking the middle path, which led to Miss Tover. Clem crossed by the right-hand track towards the inn. Thomason, being left alone, took off some of her wet garments, carried the baby upstairs to Clem's bed, and then came down to the sitting room again, where she made a larger fire, and began drying herself. The fire soon flared up the chimney, giving the room an appearance of comfort that was doubled by contrast with the drumming of the storm without, which snapped at the window panes and breathed into the chimney strange low utterances that seemed to be the prologue to some tragedy. But the least part of Thomason was in the house, for her heart being at ease about the little girl upstairs, she was mentally following Clem on his journey. Having indulged in this imaginary peregrination for some considerable interval, she became impressed with a sense of the intolerable slowness of time. But she sat on. The moment then came when she could scarcely sit longer, and it was like a satire on her patience to remember that Clem could hardly have reached the inn as yet. At last she went to the baby's bedside. The child was sleeping soundly, but her imagination of possibly disastrous events at her home, the predominance within her of the unseen over the seen, agitated her beyond endurance. She could not refrain from going down and opening the door. The rain still continued, the candlelight falling upon the nearest drops, and making glistening darts of them as they descended across the throng of invisible ones behind. To plunge into that medium was to plunge into water slightly diluted with air. But the difficulty of returning to her house at this moment made her all the more desirous of doing so. Anything was better than suspense. I have come here well enough, she said, and why shouldn't I go back again? It is a mistake for me to be away. As he hastily fetched the infant, wrapped it up, cloaked herself as before, and shoveling the ashes over the fire, to prevent accidents, went into the open air. Pausing first to put the door key in its old place behind the shutter, she resolutely turned her face to the confronting pile of firmamental darkness beyond the palings, and stepped into its midst. But Thomason's imagination being so actively engaged elsewhere, the night and the weather had for her no terror beyond that of their actual discomfort and difficulty. She was soon ascending Bloom's End Valley, and traversing the undulations on the side of the hill. The noise of the wind over the heath was shrill, and as if it whistled for joy at finding a night so congenial as this. Sometimes the path led her to hollows between thickets of tall and dripping bracken, dead, though not yet prostrate, which enclosed her like a pool. When they were more than usually tall, she lifted the baby to the top of her head, that it might be out of the reach of their drenching fronds. On higher ground, where the wind was brisk and sustained, the rain flew in a level flight without sensible descent, so that it was beyond all power to imagine the remoteness of the point at which it left the bosoms of the clouds. Here self-defense was impossible, and individual drops stuck into her like the arrows into St. Sebastian. She was enabled to avoid puddles by the nebulous paleness which signified their presence, though beside anything less dark than the heath they themselves would have appeared as blackness. Yet in spite of all this, Thomason was not sorry that she had started. To her there were not, as to Eustacia, demons in the air, and malice in every bush and bough. The drops which lashed her face were not scorpions, but prosy rain. Egdon in the mass was no monster whatever, but impersonal open ground. Her fears of the place were rational, her dislikes of its worst moods reasonable. At this time it was in her view a windy, wet place, in which a person might experience much discomfort, lose the path without care, and possibly catch cold. If the path is well known, the difficulty at such times of keeping there is not altogether great, from its familiar feel to the feet, but once lost it is irrecoverable. Owing to her baby, who somewhat impeded Thomason's view forward, and distracted her mind, she did at last lose the track. This mishap occurred when she was descending an open slope about two-thirds home. Instead of attempting, by wandering hither and thither, the hopeless task of finding such a mere thread, she went straight on, trusting for guidance to her general knowledge of the contours, which was scarcely surpassed by Klim's, or by that of the heathcroppers themselves. At length Thomason reached a hollow, and began to discern through the rain a faint blotted radiance, which presently assumed the oblong form of an open door. She knew that no house stood hereabouts, and was soon aware of the nature of the door by its height above the ground. "Why, it is Diggory Venn's van, surely," she said. A certain secluded spot near Rainbarrow was, she knew, often Venn's chosen center when staying in this neighborhood, and she guessed at once that as he had stumbled upon this mysterious retreat. The question arose in her mind, whether or not she should ask him to guide her into the path. In her anxiety to reach home she decided that she would appeal to him, notwithstanding the strangeness of appearing before his eyes at this place and season. But when, in pursuance of this resolve, Thomason reached the van and looked in, she found it to be untenanted, though there was no doubt that it was the Redolmans. The fire was burning in the stove, the lantern hung from the nail. Round the doorway the floor was merely sprinkled with rain, and not saturated, which told her that the door had not long been opened. While she stood uncertainly looking in, Thomason heard a footstep advancing from the darkness behind her, and turning, beheld the well-known form in corduroy, lurid from head to foot, the lantern beams falling upon him through an intervening gauze of raindrops. "I thought you went down the slope," he said, without noticing her face. "How do you come back here again?" "Diggory?" said Thomason faintly. "Who are you?" said Venn, still unperceiving. "And why were you crying so just now?" "Oh, Diggory. Don't you know me?" said she. "But of course you don't, wrapped up like this. What do you mean?" "I have not been crying here, and I have not been here before." Venn then came nearer till he could see the illuminated side of her form. "Mrs. Wildev," he exclaimed, starting. "Had a time for us to meet. And the baby too. What dreadful thing can have brought you out on such a night as this?" She could not immediately answer, and without asking her permission he hopped into his van, took her by the arm, and drew her up after him. "What is it?" he continued when they stood within. "I have lost my way coming from Bloom's End, and I am in a great hurry to get home. Please show me as quickly as you can. It is so silly of me not to know Egdon better, and I cannot think how I came to lose the path. Show me quickly, Diggory, please." "Yes, of course. I will go with thee. But you came to me before this, Mrs. Wildev?" "I only came this minute." "That's strange. I was lying down here asleep about 5 minutes ago, with the door shut to keep out the weather, when the brushing of a woman's clothes over the heath bushes just outside woke me up, for I don't sleep heavy, and at the same time I heard a sobbing or crying from the same woman. I opened my door and held out my lantern, and just as far as the light would reach I saw a woman. She turned her head, when the light sheened on her, and then hurried on downhill. I hung up the lantern, and was curious enough to pull on my things and dog her a few steps, but I could see nothing of her anymore. That was where I had been when you came up, and when I saw you, I thought you were the same one. Perhaps it was one of the heath folk going home? No, it couldn't be. 'Tis too late. The noise of her gown over the heath was of a whistling sort that nothing but silk will make. It wasn't I, then. My dress is not silk, you see. Are we anywhere in a line between Miss Tover and the inn?" "Well, yes. Not far out. Ah, I wonder if it was she. Diggory, I must go at once. She jumped down from the van, before he was aware, when Ven unhooked the lantern and leaped down after her. I'll take the baby, ma'am, he said. You must be tired out by the wait. Thomason hesitated a moment, and then delivered the baby into Ven's hands. Aunt squeeze her, Diggory, she said, or hurt her little arm, and keep the cloak close over her like this, so that the rain may not drop in her face. I will, said Ven earnestly. As if I could hurt anything belonging to you. I only meant accidentally, said Thomason. The baby is dry enough, but you are pretty wet, said the Redelman when, in closing the door of his car to padlock it, he noticed on the floor a ring of water drops, where her cloak had hung from her. Thomason followed him as he wound right and left to avoid the larger bushes, stopping occasionally and covering the lantern, while he looked over his shoulder, to gain some idea of the position of Rain Barrow above them, which it was necessary to keep directly behind their backs, to preserve a proper course. You are sure the rain does not fall upon baby? Quite sure. May I ask how old he is, ma'am? He, said Thomason reproachfully. Nobody can see better than that in a moment. She is nearly 2 months old. How far is it now to the inn? A little over a quarter of a mile. Will you walk a little faster? I was afraid you could not keep up. I am very anxious to get there. Ah, there is a light from the window. 'Tis not from the window. That's a gig lamp, to the best of my belief. Oh, said Thomason in despair. Wish I had been there sooner. Give me the baby, Diggory. You can go back now. I must go all the way, said Ven. Here is a quag between us and that light, and you will walk into it up to your neck, unless I take you round. But the light is at the inn, and there is no quag in front of that. No, the light is below the inn some 200 or 300 yards. Never mind, said Thomason hurriedly. Oh, towards the light, and not towards the inn. Yes, answered Ven, swerving round in obedience. And, after a pause, I wish you would tell me what this great trouble is. I think you have proved that I can be trusted. There are some things that cannot be told to, and then her heart rose into her throat, and she could say no more. 9 sights and sounds draw the wanderers together. Having seen the Eustatia signal from the hill at 8 o'clock, Wildev immediately prepared to assist her in her flight, and, as he hoped, accompany her. He was somewhat perturbed, and his manner of informing Thomason that he was going on a journey was in itself sufficient to rouse her suspicions. When as he had gone to bed he collected the few articles he would require, and went upstairs to the money chest, whence he took a tolerably bountiful sum in notes, which had been advanced to him on the property he was so soon to have in possession, to defray expenses incidental to the removal. He then went to the stable and coach house to assure himself that the horse, gig, and harness were in a fit condition for a long drive. Nearly half an hour was spent thus, and on returning to the house Wildev had no thought of Thomason being anywhere but in bed. He had told the stable lad not to stay up, leading the boy to understand that his departure would be at 3 or 4 in the morning, for this, though an exceptional hour, was less strange than midnight, the time actually agreed on, the packet from Budmouth sailing between 1 and 2. At last all was quiet, and he had nothing to do but to wait. By no effort could he shake off the oppression of spirits which he had experienced ever since his last meeting with Eustatia, but he hoped there was that in his situation which money could cure. He had persuaded himself that to act not ungenerously towards his gentle Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.